Welcome to Eastern Standard, a service of WEKU produced with the support of Alltech, working together for a planet of plenty, and Dynamics Productions. I'm Tom Martin, and Tad Long has stopped in for a visit. It's Tad's job to travel this very large state of ours, working with towns and cities that have issues that they want to overcome. Tad's the Director of Community Development Services at the Kentucky League of Cities. Greetings, Tad.
Hello, Tom. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. I'd like to get your assessment of how you think the cities that you've seen are faring in the areas of things like job growth, population growth or decline, quality of life, their leadership. What's your take on the situation?
It's a mixed bag. Having been across the state numerous times in the past several months, we have pockets of places that are recovering nicely and doing really great things and prospering, and we have others that are really struggling just to exist.
Our focus, of course, is on the central and the eastern regions of the Commonwealth. And I know that you and your team have completed community reports for a number of cities in the area, London, Prestonsburg, Ellesmere, Jenkins. You've done a feasibility study for a project in Grant County. Understand that you're looking at Hazard now. While we can't go into each of them in detail, and I want to get back to Hazard in a moment, we will post these reports on the facts and information page on our website. That's esweku.com. So what do people in these communities say they need or want?
I think everybody wants a nice and safe place to live, a place where they can grow a family or retire comfortably and have things to do, jobs. Obviously is number one. The opioid crisis and the drug problem is universal. But by and large, it's really they want nice local places to live and good jobs so that they can make a living.
And what are some of the most significant impediments to those goals?
Well, I think that for some, it's resistance to change. People don't like change, and yet it's forced upon them by circumstances. Mm-hmm. Another is apathy. People have this feeling that someone's going to come and rescue them. And while there are a lot of folks that certainly want to try to help do that, and I'm one of those, it is really up to the local community to solve its problems. And, I think that that's a reality that's dawning on some of these communities, that the cavalry is not coming. We're it.
Some see that cavalry in the youth of the region, the future of the region. We also hear of many young people departing the region and maybe not even coming back. It's a big problem. How do we get to that future that people envision if we're losing the young people who will soon be the adults in leadership roles?
Well, to the credit of leadership in the places in which we have worked, they have embraced our idea of actually going to schools and sitting down and having conversations with students. And we do several activities with students, and the local leadership, the mayor and some of the council members and some of the folks that are involved in the community will attend those and listen. And they have some great ideas. The thing that I find most troubling is that the young people, the students, don't seem to know of the opportunities that are in the community. And I don't think anyone talks to them about that. And we're working in Hazard, and we had a great, great meeting with Hazard High School students, juniors and seniors. And I asked how many thought that they would leave after they graduated. And probably 80% said they would. And I said, how many of you would stay here or would come back here if you had the opportunity to have the kind of job that would, satisfy your career path or what you wanted to do? And probably 75% said that they would like to stay in their hometown. And to me, that's kind of a stunning statistic. But we have to create the kinds of opportunities that they want if we're going to keep them. But on the flip side, Tom, a lot of kids just want to leave. They want to see something else. And I tell cities at the same time, the next town over may have folks, that young people that want to leave. Maybe they'll come to your town.
True.
So it kind of works both ways.
Well, to your earlier point, your report from Jenkins is kind of instructive. There's an interesting paragraph there. I'll read it here. It says, quote, "It's the nature of people to generally blame someone or something for their problems. Many people outside of eastern Kentucky try to blame coal or the people or the politicians for the economic conditions that face the area. Blame makers look for blame takers. Blaming someone or something is somehow supposed to make it all better. It never does. In the end, the only thing that matters is that someone steps up to change the circumstances, taking ownership." Are you hearing any of that happening?
Yes. I think that there is a dawning of the recognition that the coal industry has served eastern Kentucky well for the past 100 or more years. But there are always these ups and downs. And several of our leaders have now decided that we hope it comes back. We're prepared if it comes back. But what if it doesn't come back? We need to diversify our economy and look at other opportunities. And I think that that's a very positive step. It's hard for people to change. And, you know, as someone from central Kentucky, not eastern Kentucky, I don't want to be the carpetbagger going in telling them how to solve their problem.
Another project that I saw in your materials that really intrigued me is happening in Grant County. And listener, if you're with us in your car and you're on I-75 between Corinth and Crittenden, then you're in Grant County. Tell us what's happening there.
They're wanting to create a greenway trail system that stretches from the south tip of Grant County, which is up against the Scott County line, mm-hmm. all the way north to Florence. And this all started with a desire to reduce childhood obesity in the schools. And they implemented a number of projects, you know, including community gardens and walking paths and that sort of thing. And they said, let's create a trail system. And let's connect our places, you know, to northern Kentucky and to the Legacy Trail. Let's do that. And so we did. Over a period of several months, we engaged a lot of local stakeholders and pulled together the data. And, yes, it's feasible to do it. And here's what it'll cost. And here's where it could go. And this is the minimal impact on private property owners. And I'm estimating probably half, maybe a little more, is already completed. And
about how many miles would that be?
It's 48 miles total.
Uh-huh.
So I'm saying around 20 to 25 miles is done.
So this is an example of a plan coming to fruition.
Yes.
And these days we hear a lot of people saying they're tired of plans. They want to see this kind of action. Why do you have to have that plan?
Well, I think that it pulls together partnerships that might not otherwise happen. You've got, you know, a group in Grant County of about 20 that like to ride horseback, and they have a trail that they use. And those folks are not likely to talk to the school superintendent about how they can expand the trails because they don't see the connection. Hmm. And so what we try to do is bring the folks together and get them on a page of agreement and help them to see a bigger way forward. So plans are important, but I will say, Tom, and I tell folks this, when I die, I don't want it to say on my tombstone, Tad Long had a plan. I want it to say Tad Long did something. And so we have taken this mantra on that, yes, we're here to help you plan, but we're also here to help you move to action and do things. And sometimes it takes a long time, you know.
Mm-hmm. Sure does. And one thing that seems to be kind of coalescing in the eastern region of the state is the idea that maybe tourism is something that we ought to look at more seriously. We certainly have the assets, mm-hmm. the natural assets in particular. Are you hearing that? And what do you hear about any cities that are making efforts to accommodate tourism?
Well, I'll give you two examples, and there are many. You mentioned Jenkins. One of the things that Jenkins wanted to do was tie into the Appalachian Trail system. And so, you know, we explored that and discovered some potential partnerships and a path forward with that. And they partnered with Virginia Tech, which Jenkins is right on the line. And so they've been working to bring that to fruition. Prestonsburg is another. They have in excess of 100 young people, and I'm talking about the prime age of 25 to 35 that come to that community every weekend when the weather permits to kayak down the Levisa Fork. And they stick around for music night at the local restaurants, and they go to the MAC for entertainment or the amphitheater at Jenny Wiley State Park. And they're turning that into, rather than an overnight experience, a 3 or 4 day experience. So those are just two examples. Again, there are many, but this is a part of the local solution to a problem that can have a regional effect.
Tad Long is Director of Community Development Services at the Kentucky League of Cities. Thank you, Tad.
Thank you so much.
And this is my town. Yeah, this is my town.
Hey, well, I was born. A cluster of eastern Kentucky counties, not Perry, Letcher, Leslie, and Harlan, now has their own tourism website. Visit easternkentucky.org. It was developed with the support of the Mountain Association for Community Economic Development, MACED. And in a moment, we'll hear from MACED's Josh Bills and Homes, Inc. Director Seth Long about the interest in solar power among businesses and nonprofits in the coal fields of eastern Kentucky.
Solar energy isn't against anything. It's not for or against coal. It can be a common sense business solution for everybody that's trying to keep their doors open.
And an opportunity to introduce a new sector of work in the mountains that's not there now.
And racehorse deaths in Kentucky. Why is the state so secretive about the circumstances? A report from the Kentucky Center for Investigative Reporting. I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.
A planet of peril or plenty? We choose to believe in the latter. With the advent of new technologies, the adoption of improved management practices, and above all, the ingenuity inherent in the human spirit, a world of abundance could be ours. Alltech, working together for a planet of plenty.
Major support for Eastern Standard on WEKU is provided by the law firm Hicks & Funson. Kentucky lawyers Josh Hicks, Greg Funson, and Shannon Church provide legal advice and representation in the areas of personal injury, catastrophic accident, and immigration law. Learn more at hfkylawyers.com. Eastern Standard continues with Tom Martin.
Due to rising energy rates, loss of coal severance revenues, and disinvestment in the region, people in eastern Kentucky are taking responsibility for the future of their economy and their economic independence on their own. And a number of eastern Kentucky communities have been exploring and installing solar power and other forms of renewable energy toward that end. They include the Kentucky Coal Museum, the Campton Baptist Church, and the cities of Lynch, Livingston, and Mount Vernon. 4 community organizations in Letcher County are going solar. And here to fill us in on those projects are Josh Bills, a commercial energy specialist at MACED, the Mountain Association for Community Economic Development, and Seth Long, director of Housing-Oriented Ministries Established for Service, or HOMES. Thanks for joining us, Josh and Seth.
It's good to be here.
Thank you.
Tell us a little bit about the Letcher County Culture Hub. Seth, you actually direct one of the organizations in the Culture Hub that's going solar. Can you tell us about that?
Sure. So the Letcher County Culture Hub is a group of very different organizations politically and socially, and we've gotten together sitting around the table to work on issues in the community, all sorts of issues that matter to each of us regardless of our affiliations and things. So it's been exciting work to be a part of. But one of the things that we all struggle with is the cost of doing business, operating costs. And we are all impacted by rising electrical costs. And a couple of years ago, we got together thinking, how can we deal with the rising cost of energy? How is it going to keep our community centers open, the fire companies open, the lack of coal severance money?
So we started exploring ways that we could reduce operating costs, and solar energy was one of those areas that we were quickly drawn to think about, because at Homes Incorporated, part of our work is related to energy efficiency. We go into homes and businesses too and evaluate, but we'd never really before this considered solar energy seriously.
And again, Josh Bills is with the Mountain Association for Community Economic Development. Josh, how is MESED helping with this solar project?
Well, we identified it as an opportunity for a number of the organizations, and particularly because there was some strong interest there with those organizations. And we created and did the language for a request for proposal and sent that out to contractors, thinking that we would get one contractor to be able to sort of aggregate and pool all these projects together and get, you know, cost benefit savings from having a larger body of work in Letcher County. They had to travel from Louisville, Danville, or Lexington. That is one challenge, is, you know, not having the installer base there yet to do this work. But it ended up that the organizations had different needs, and there were different timing, and based on the actual projects, it ended up being two different contractors that were awarded separate projects within those pool of folks.
Okay. In this most recent session, the state legislature passed and Governor Bevin signed Senate Bill 100, also known as the Net Metering Bill. What does this bill do?
A lot of people define net metering as being a one-to-one ratio. So any electricity that you generate, if it happens to be generating amount that is more than you're using it at any given time, that electricity gets credited on your electric bill just as if it was the cost associated with purchasing. And it's not a payment. You can't get a check from your utility by having solar on your roof. It's a credit that if you have more credit generated in a month than you use, that credit would just carry forward and be a balance on your bill for the next month. And what this bill does is it sets up a scenario where the likelihood of having a reduced credit value for what happens to be pushed out to the grid at any time is what we could be facing. So the economics would be reduced, particularly with working families that, you know, are nobody's there at their house during the day and they're using electricity at night. Those would be impacted more than, you know, like a larger facility, maybe a commercial facility that's operating during the day. They might not be impacted at all because they wouldn't be putting electricity out to the grid.
And Seth, as you said, your organization and other members of the Letcher Culture Hub were just getting to the point where they were looking at solar as a really good, viable alternative, and then this bill was passed. What kind of impact does that have on your ability to plan along the lines of renewable energy and solar?
Yeah, so I think for us, we will get in under the deadline to get our system installed under the current net metering situation, be grandfathered into the current deal. Where it really impacts people are the people that can see how this is working, that want to invest in solar energy to save dollars on their business, their operating costs in the future. They won't get the payback as quickly as what we're getting payback.
And so you've mentioned grandfathering a couple of times. There is grandfathering built into the bill?
Yeah, so anybody that existing has a net metering arrangement with their solar is going to be grandfathered in at least 25 years, because it'll be 25 years from the point that a utility goes before the Public Service Commission to get a rate set for what that value should be. At that point, it's 25 years. So anybody that installs, has installed, or installs up until that point, which will be sometime in 2020 likely, and not until 2020, is going to be grandfathered in for 25 years.
So let's say you're the owner of one of these properties that's grandfathered, and 10, 15 years down the line, you decide to sell that property. Will this transfer, the grandfathering transfer?
Yeah, and that is an improvement in the bill language this year that was not included in prior sessions. And it's a really important point, because there were some families that were like, well, you know, we want to pass on our home to our next of kin. We want them to have same benefit if we're going to be making this investment.
Now, as I understand it, there's still a great deal that's unknown. A lot of it turns on how the Public Service Commission is going to act, and that's off in the future a bit. Any idea when the PSC will take this up?
We don't know. It's going to come from the first utility that wants to set that rate. You know, there are costs involved in attorney fees and such to bring a case before the PSC, but at the same time, there was a lot of utility initiative to get the bill passed. So we suspect that it's going to happen pretty early in 2020, but it is really hard to say. And we just don't know what that value is going to be set at. There's been so much conversation and perspectives on what that value should be. And there's a lot of entities that actually think that value might even be something above retail because of the benefits that it can bring to the grid. If you think about it, if you're looking at a house that has solar on its roof and it actually pushes out a little bit of electricity during the day, that's a very different source of electricity being distributed than a central power plant that has to transmit that electricity miles and miles and miles to its destination and have transmission losses. And then there's also this propensity for solar to generate when it's really expensive in the summertime when everybody's using electricity. Those sorts of things are going to come into play to sort of see what that value is going to be with the PSC. And so we just don't know. But we do know that there are people interested and are going to be advocating during those public cases to get that value what it really deserves to be.
Sounds like there's going to have to be a lot of science going on between now and any rational decision.
Yeah, one of the arguments that's been made is a customer of a utility that has generation on the roof that generates more than they use during the day, that electricity gets used by the neighbor, you know, so it's using the infrastructure of the utility, maybe two poles and the wires between them and their neighbor. How could you assess all the costs of the utility infrastructure in that differential value? And yeah, it gets really complicated. You're right.
Okay, Seth, coming back around to you, you are the director of HOMES, as we've mentioned, an organization that's been around quite a while. For context sake, first, if you could just tell us just briefly about the mission of HOMES.
Sure. The mission of HOMES Incorporated is affordable housing. I often say we're all things housing. So we have built 243 affordable new homes in a region that's difficult to develop where there's very little houses that are built and put up for sale. We do many, many rehabs every year, working on people's houses, putting windows, heat pumps, roofs on the houses. And then we have rental availabilities too. So we do a lot with housing. We also are a partner in the Appalachian Heat Squad program. That's a program designed to help everyone, regardless of income, save money on their electric bills. We go in and assess people's houses and make recommendations of what they can do to save money and to see what kind of return on the investment they'll get on that investment to save energy.
So I have to imagine you were looking at solar, and maybe still are looking at solar as a response to that.
We have looked at it, but you know, this demonstration to us going through the process has really opened our eyes to the possibilities and how solar can actually pay for itself without grants or subsidies involved too. That was kind of a surprise to us commercially. With the demand charges that increase so much on commercial accounts, it made all the difference to us in considering solar. And we hope that through our projects in Letcher County, that in the mountains and in our communities, that we can be an example of what other businesses, not just nonprofits, but small businesses can do to lower their bottom line. Because it's so hard and difficult in our changing economy to stay afloat with a small business. This could just be another tool in the toolbox to keep a business open.
Is it fair to say, do you think that there's a real appeal in that to the desire among people in the region to find independence and to be able to generate their own power and not rely on outside sources?
I think it's a response to crisis. In the coal fields, in the changing economy, we've seen so many people leave. It's hard to keep our businesses open. And often in crisis, there's opportunity. So it forces us to go think a different way outside of the box. And that's what this opportunity has been for us. And we really hope to highlight that so other people can consider that. It'll be an example. And we're here to share and to teach people and to help them understand how it might save them money on their electric bills.
I've been in a number of conversations and experiences with, you know, there is this pioneering spirit in the mountains and this independence. And it's surprised me because I've often thought if we bring solar and the what it can mean in terms of saving money for businesses to business owners, that might actually be a turnoff because of this legacy of coal and what that means. But surprising to me, it has not. There is a real interest in solar for most people in the mountains.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I think that one of the stories that we want to tell is that solar energy isn't against anything. It's not for or against coal. It can be a common sense business solution for everybody that's trying to keep their doors open.
And an opportunity to introduce a new sector of work in the mountains that's not there now.
And that's something that's exciting for us. The agreement that we have with the solar contractor is that our in-house construction crews are actually going to do the install on the solar system under their supervision to be trained so that when they have another install in the region, we can be a installer for this company too. So we're excited about that.
Josh Bills is a commercial energy specialist at MACED, the Mountain Association for Community Economic Development. And Seth Long is director of the Whitesburg-based Housing-Oriented Ministries Established for Service, or HOMES, Inc. And he's also owner of Southbound Farm in the Letcher County community of Ermine. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Tom.
Thank you very much.
Racehorse deaths are on the rise in Kentucky, but the state is unusually secretive about the circumstances. While other states with major races openly share when, where, and which horses die, racing officials in the home of the Derby say state law protects the horses' privacy. Caitlin McGlade with the Kentucky Center for Investigative Reporting explored why that is and why it's a problem.
It's 2 weeks after the Derby at Churchill Downs, first race of the day.
They're in the gate and they're off.
It's also the first race ever for Kinley Carroll, a 3-year-old filly. She pulls out slow. For the first minute, she is trailing far behind the pack. Then she starts to catch up.
Lady of Dragonstone is still in front.
The announcer doesn't mention it, but right at that moment, her back leg snaps. In video of the race, she disappears from the frame with an obvious leg injury, and the others charge forward. Kinley Carroll was euthanized. But even in the midst of a huge national conversation about horse racing deaths, she never made headlines. In fact, the only mention of her death is on a website called horseracingwrongs.com, run by an activist named Patrick Bacciuolo. He scours racing charts every day for code words. The racing chart from May 16th at Churchill Downs says Kinley Carroll went wrong.
Things like took a bad step, pulled up in distress, banned off, went wrong is a euphemism that is commonly used at Kentucky tracks.
Bacciuolo does all of this sleuthing because the Kentucky Horse Racing Commission doesn't report details about horse deaths. A lot of other states consider identities of horses that died, as well as where and when they died, to be public record. But here in Kentucky, the horse racing capital of the world, officials say open records law protects the business interests of horse trainers and owners. Amy Bensonhaver, with the Kentucky Open Government Coalition, says that's a problem because it makes it harder to hold accountable some of the racing industry's biggest players.
Establishing these impediments to access, they are tipping the balance in favor of the industry rather than the public's right to know. And we have an interest as great as theirs insofar as it is one of our greatest and most well-known industries.
Earlier this month, I asked the Kentucky Horse Racing Commission for data on racehorse deaths and injuries in the state. The commission wouldn't turn it over because they said it wasn't public record. I also asked for necropsies filed by veterinarians. Officials said they would give those to me, but with a big caveat. They'd redact the name of the horse, where and when it died, who owned it, and really any information they thought I could use to identify the horse. Why? So there's this exemption in open records law that says the state doesn't have to release documents if it would cause competitive disadvantage. And releasing horse identities would do that for trainers and owners, according to the Horse Racing Commission.
I really question the wisdom of a statement like that.
That's James Gagliano, the president of the Jockey Club, the thoroughbred breed registry for the United States and Canada. His organization encourages racetracks to report death and injury statistics.
These are facts, and there's nothing wrong with reporting facts.
So I called around to other states. New Jersey, home of the Haskell Invitational Stakes. The information's not confidential there. California, spokesman Mike Martin had a list from Santa Anita on hand.
Yes, yeah, I may have to send that to you within the next minute if you ask me for it, yeah.
That track suspended racing after a spate of fatalities.
He said I could get information on deaths at other tracks through a records request for fatalities that are not under investigation. Maryland's Racing Commission emailed me a statewide list after a quick phone call, the Monday after Preakness. And Illinois?
Sure, absolutely.
That's Mickey Izzo, project manager for the Illinois Racing Board. And here's the thing. Competitive disadvantage doesn't seem to be an issue there.
I've been doing this for 20 years and never have gotten any complaints from horsemen when that information was released to the public. Nope.
In New York, which will host the third leg of the Triple Crown at Belmont Park this weekend, racing officials publish an online database of horse deaths and injuries, so I didn't even have to ask for it. Trainer Robert Barbera lost a horse named Tommy T during a race in Queens, New York this year. His name pops up in the database.
If it's out there, it's out there. I mean, it happens, you know.
Tommy T broke a leg bone and was euthanized on the track.
I mean, if people go to the internet and see this stuff that, you know, I had 5 horses break down in 2 years or something like that, will it mean something to somebody? I guess it will. Does it bother me? No, it doesn't, because it is what it is.
Racing deaths have been on the rise nationally, and Kentucky had 38 race fatalities last year. That was nearly double the deaths in 2017. Kentucky's equine medical director, Mary Scalay, declined an interview request and didn't respond to written questions. Susan West, a spokesperson for the Kentucky Horse Racing Commission, said in an emailed statement that other states keep the name of injured and dead horses confidential, too. She did not specify which states. West also noted that the agency will confirm the deaths of specific horses when asked, and she confirmed that Kenley Carroll died after that race at Churchill Downs last month. Larry DeMeritt was a 3-year-old filly's trainer. He was at the track that day watching her race.
You go from excitement to heartbroken.
He has 10 horses in his stable now at the Thoroughbred Center in Lexington. He says losing Kenley Carroll was really hard.
And that's like one of your kids you just lost. So, no, it's people don't know. These animals, we spend more time around them than we do ourselves, our families.
DeMeritt doesn't think what happened to her should be confidential. He thinks transparency helps dispel mystery and that it might actually help the industry.
I would like to see that people trust us more in the game. So the more secret you are, the people always think there's something shady about it.
DeMeritt says it doesn't bother him if people know he trained Kenley Carroll or that she died, because he has nothing to hide. For the Kentucky Center for Investigative Reporting, I'm Caitlin McGlade.
After the break, guest arts interviewer Sky Marietta puts in a call to Montana to investigate an idea for the artists of Eastern Kentucky.
One of the things that I value about this program is that it encourages artists to not become widget makers, you know, to continue to push their artwork and their expression so that they themselves stay vibrant and they don't lose that joy of why they want to be artists.
And from our partner Undermain, Art Sheckett on the celebration of Juneteenth coming to the Lyric Theater in Lexington.
I'm originally from Texas, and kind of the background of Juneteenth was that after the Emancipation Proclamation came out, there was not great messaging to get down to the enslaved population in Texas. And for 2 years after, they stayed enslaved. But on June 19th, 1865 was the kind of celebration of freedom.
I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.
A planet of peril or plenty? We choose to believe in the latter. With the advent of new technologies, the adoption of improved management practices, and above all, the ingenuity inherent in the human spirit, a world of abundance could be ours. Alltech. Working together for a planet of plenty.
Major support for Eastern Standard on WEKU is provided by the law firm Hicks & Funson. Kentucky lawyers Josh Hicks, Greg Funson, and Shannon Church provide legal advice and representation in the areas of personal injury, catastrophic accident, and immigration law. Learn more at hfkylawyers.com. Eastern Standard continues with Tom Martin.
It can be worthwhile to look at how others are working to achieve a goal that's very similar to your own. In this case, helping the artists of Eastern Kentucky make a living without sacrificing creative vision and energy. This came to mind when we heard about a success story in one of the most rural of all American states, Montana, where Tatiana Gant heads the state's Arts Council and oversees the Montana Artrepreneur Program. Since developing the creative economy of Eastern Kentucky is a goal of UK Arts Extension Associate Sky Marietta, we invited Sky to put in a call to Tatiana. Let's listen in.
Hello, Tatiana. Thank you for being with us. We're really excited to talk to you about what's going on in Montana. And, you know, your program was brought up in this action guide for rural prosperity. And it's from the National Governors Association talking about state-level policy and recommendations. And I think it's really helpful to think about what's going on at the state. Can you give us a landscape view of what's happening in Montana and how the arts are positioned in Montana in the state government?
Sure. Hello, Sky. Thanks for having me. So one thing I think is hard for people to understand is just how vast Montana is. We have an average population density of just 7 people per square mile. And we actually have 45 counties that classify as frontier. Now, the definition of frontier can vary, but we're really looking for communities with less than 6 people per square mile and a significant distance to services. And in those 45 Montana counties that are frontier, they have an average population of just 3 people per square mile. So I can't stress the space of Montana enough. However, despite or perhaps because of that space, Montana's economy is really growing. So employment and wages and economic productivity are all rising. And Montana is frequently ranked at the top of the Kaufman Index of Entrepreneurship. So there's a lot of growth happening in Montana that is the balance to all of that space and low population. However, a lot of that growth is focused in just 5 of Montana's big cities. And when I say big city, our very largest city of Billings is 100,000 people, so fairly small. And what we're trying to hold on to in Montana is protecting that love of space, that people move here and live here because they want to be able to have land and air and live in remote places. So thinking that Montana is about 1 million people, our creative industries provide about 1,500 jobs for Montana workers.
And how do you think in a place like Montana, where obviously part of the way that you're managed to grow the economy is through cultural heritage tourism, through branding the place, what role does arts play in Montana as a driver of economic development?
You know, the arts enhanced a lot of what you just mentioned. Obviously, people come here for tourism and stay longer and spend more because of the arts. The arts also are what makes a lot of our smaller communities really desirable. Fort Peck is an example of theater celebrating its 50th year. It's way up in the northeastern corner of Montana, and people come from all over to enjoy the theater there. So, you know, the arts support economy, they support the businesses that work here, and then they also support the off seasons for seasonal workers. So for example, through our entrepreneur program, we've trained people who are ranchers and use their downtime in the winter to create artwork.
Great. Well, let's talk about your entrepreneur program and how you work to support artists. I know you've just gotten some results. Can you give us a nutshell or a quick overview or some of the things you're seeing from your program?
Yeah, so in our most recent report, well, we can show that we've trained more than 450 artists in the about 10-year history of the program, and that's just the part that the Montana Arts Council has invested in. What we've found is that when artists spend the time developing these, what we refer to as a toolkit, there's like 35 tools in the kit, and when they spend the time developing that, it really focuses them in on the purpose of their artwork, so that they're staying connected to their creativity and why they want to make artwork. It helps them articulate that and define their key audience so that then they can focus their marketing and promotion efforts on those who are most open to their artwork. And I think the most stunning statistic to share is that when we look at artists who started in the early cohorts and we just measured them based on their, I believe it's their 2016 tax information, but their most recent available tax information, we saw a 654% increase in their net art sales. And that just blows my mind.
Well, that's very impressive results.
Yeah. And one of the exciting things, you know, I've talked about Montana, very big. We do have people coming in, and so a lot of these artists have figured out how to sell in their communities or sell within Montana. But what we think another really impressive strength of the program is it helps artists understand how to sell their work outside of Montana. They focus on approaching galleries and art fairs, and the artists that have gone through the program and, you know, successfully completed their toolkit, 60% of the artists are finding that they've increased their sales outside of Montana, some as much as 38%.
It sounds like you do this balance of helping people focus on their creative drive, as well as helping them develop or nurture a business mindset and being able to be responsive to clients or to markets. Do you see any really key aspects of that for your participants?
Yeah, you know, I have to. So I trained as an artist and at a time when we were sort of encouraged to believe that if you made good art, people would find you and your art would just be consumed. And at that time in the 80s and the 90s, I think there was this idea that when you found the thing that was good, you keep making it. And one of the things that I value about this program is that it encourages artists to not become widget makers, you know, to continue to push their artwork and their expression so that they themselves stay vibrant and they don't lose that joy of why they want to be artists. So that's one thing that I think is a real strength of this program. And then also the fact that it helps them communicate about their artwork so that they're better able to interface with people who are interested in their work, and they're encouraged to think about their price points. So they often think of having more accessible pieces that balance out their masterpieces that work as a point of entry for people to start to become collectors. So as they're developing their own creative business, they're also helping to develop the consumer side of it by educating people about the arts and what's involved. And it's just a real full spectrum of growth.
I love that. Accessible pieces as well as masterpieces. I'm going to have to remember that line and use it with people.
You know, and I have to say, like, when I've gone to see these, and you can really spot the artists who have gone through the program when I'm at sales, and they've got, like, a, you know, greeting cards are a common thing, or small, but very authentic pieces of their work, but much more accessible. And it really does create sort of like a gateway into getting to know the artist and collecting their work.
Well, one thing that you've had the advantage of, you've worked in a couple different states. You were in Illinois before you came to Montana, right?
Right.
So as hoping to get a little bit of your perspective of what might be universal. So if we could imagine that, say, the Kentucky governor, which is Matt Bevin, was listening to this program, do you have any big advice, any big takeaways that you've seen be very important to supporting artists across more than one state context?
You know, that's a really good question. And I know that we often want to be able to take a good example and translate it somewhere else. And I have to say that the Montana Artrepreneur Program is designed in such a way to really respect rural artists, and I think it's very true to what's happening in Montana. And I will balance that against what I saw in Illinois and what I imagine happens in other parts of the country, which is that artists need such a network of support that it seems easier for them to live in metropolitan areas. So looking at Illinois, you know, half of the population of the state is in the Chicago area. And that was something we always struggled with, is how do we support what seemed like small towns, but, you know, a town even like Peoria or Bloomington is a significant city center, yet the draw of that metropolitan area was so strong that artists felt that they needed to be there and actually did have more resources when they were in a dense population place. So if I were advising Kentucky on how they were going to support artists, I think it really goes back to looking at what drives the artist to be there. So although there were many artists in Illinois who enjoyed the rural lifestyle, I think the draw of the city was big, and the uniqueness of Montana and artists wanting to take part and be immersed in the beauty of its rural communities developed this program. So I don't know Kentucky well enough to know how that balance of urban and rural works, but you know, this program was developed out of listening and observing what would help artists keep the creative life they wanted.
Well, we definitely have, we're a diverse state, but we definitely have a very strong cultural center in our Appalachian region and our mountain region. So I think there's a lot of lessons learned, especially for our rural artists in eastern Kentucky and how they can hold on to that sense of place in their art.
And I would, you know, agree that I think that Kentucky has such a variety of traditional art forms that are really rooted in family. And that seems like the perfect place for Kentucky to start.
Oh, I love it. Well, thank you so much for talking to us and letting us know more about all the great things going on with the Artrepreneur Program in Montana.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Lift every voice and sing, tell her this.
Art Checkit from our arts and culture partner, Undermain, is here along with Donald Mason with details on the Juneteenth celebration coming to the Lyric Theater in Lexington.
For our listeners who aren't familiar with Juneteenth, why don't you let us know something about what Juneteenth is and how it came about?
Hey, thanks for having me. And I am very excited to really get some awareness about Juneteenth. I'm originally from Texas, and kind of the background of Juneteenth was that after the Emancipation Proclamation came out, there was not great messaging to get down to the enslaved population in Texas. And for 2 years after, they stayed enslaved. But on June 19th, 1865, was the kind of celebration of freedom, of moving forward, of everybody that had been enslaved. Slavery was totally abolished, and people could start to really rebuild and restore their rights as citizens here. When I'm going back to Midland, Texas, which is my hometown, we had these Juneteenth celebrations every year. And I didn't really think much different about it because that's, you know, Texas celebrated, it happened in Texas. When I got to Lexington, I've been here for a while, but there just was a pretty big disconnection between the history of this day and what it means to all people, not just those enslaved and African Americans here in this country. I mean, this was something to where if the government mandates something and is not being taken serious all across the land, then that is a big issue from social justice and civil rights. And that was kind of the predecessor of so many other movements that happened for a century, really. If you think about 1865, civil rights movement going into 1960s, so it was not just one document that could solve all the problems, but it was the document to start the healing process and for us to come together as a nation.
A slow moving start to the March to Freedom.
Exactly.
So tell us about this event at the Lyric.
So I felt like Lexington has its own history here, and I feel like we need to be trying to move on in a positive way, not to necessarily forget about things that have happened. And so thinking about how could the Lyric have an ongoing concert that would pay homage to this event in a way that it respects it, remembers it, but moves forward as a celebration of freedom, as opposed to being held back by the negative connotations of it. Also, will bring attention, because I know that ever since we've announced that, people are, what is Juneteenth? And it's a great opportunity to have a ice-breaking conversation. It's not the most easygoing conversation, and it can get really difficult in some cases, but I think those are the topics that really need to be talked about
so
the
it's,
most.
It's a way to start the conversation,
exactly.
really,
yes.
About a part of our history that needs to be an ongoing conversation,
yes.
just not some relic that we take out every once in a while. Well, the celebration is featuring the group Nappy Roots.
Yeah.
Tell us about Nappy Roots.
Yeah, so we are so excited to have Nappy Roots come back to their roots, if you will. Based out of Louisville, met at Western Kentucky University in Bowling Green, and became really phenomenal hip-hop stars. Not necessarily overnight. We all know it takes work to get there. But when they had their moment, they were ready for it. And they've been touring for 2 decades now and really have a easygoing message. They are known for not necessarily being real vulgar in their messaging. They do, you know, talk about the things that are important to them, but they have a delivery method and it has that Kentucky feel. And they want you to know that they aren't from the big cities. They do multiple times in their songs say I-75, I-64, you know, those things that are Louisville, Lexington. They want people to know that they are from Kentucky and they don't hide from it. And I love that about them.
What else will be involved in the celebration at the Lyric besides Nappy Roots?
So we have probably the arguably hottest band locally, Jocelyn the Sweet Compression,
yeah, that
will be
terrific,
open from them.
Terrific band.
We also just want to bring people together in the community. I don't know if there's, I know there was talk about trying to bring food, but this is the first year, so I think the big thing was focusing on music and getting people to understand that this is hopefully an annual event.
So a great opportunity for the entire community to celebrate together freedom, to memorialize this important date in our history, and to come together as a community in celebration from all walks of life here. Is this a ticketed event?
It is a ticketed event. You can go to lexandlyric.tix.com for more information there, or come the day of the show, get your tickets in the box office.
Okay, June 21st at the Lyric Theater and Cultural Arts Center in Lexington, Kentucky. Juneteenth, a celebration of freedom featuring Nappy Roots along with Jocelyn and the Sweet Compression. Come out and enjoy the celebration with our community. Thanks a lot, Donald.
Thanks for having me.
Art Checkett and Donald Mason. You can check out Undermain online at under-main.com. That wraps up this week's edition. Eastern Standard is produced by WEKU in the Lexington studios of Dynamics Productions with the support of Alltech, working together for a planet of plenty. Our executive producer is Mike Savage. Neil Kesterson is our producing engineer and audio editor. You can listen to editions of Eastern Standard on the WEKU mobile app or as a podcast on NPR One, iTunes, Google Play, and Stitcher. We like to hear from you. You can email us at es@eku.edu or leave voicemail at 859-622-9358. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.